Hello and welcome to Backchat from the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM. That's 103.2 FM up in Preston. And Nicky Radio in Hertfordshire and our listeners in Swindon. And to our listeners at Verulam Radio in St Albans. Hello Radio Verulam. I'm Kirsty Paul. Coming up in the show.
The chairs, the tables and the pots and pans dancing about the room. And the kneading trough, which the old widow used to make cakes and which she sold for a little shop, that was rocking to and fro as if moved by some invisible hands. More than that, the astonished onlookers saw the dead man's boots clattering downstairs into the kitchen.
The Sidcot Poltergeist. Spooky happenings deep in Somerset.
There's been a lot of work done in recent years and a lot of work done through the Building Schools for the Future programme on things like not having lots of long, narrow corridors, not having stairwells tucked away, not having blocks of toilets that are unsupervised. Those are areas that were identified as being linked to behavioural issues in schools, and a lot of work has been done in the better schools that were designed under Building Schools for the Future to design out those problems.
Architecture and education. We hear from a leading London architect, Cindy Walters. Our first guest in the studio is our tax expert, back with us to help sort out our tax issues.
Traveling sector, I think I need a lift. And today we have Sarah Bamford in the studio to tell us more about taxes.
That's right. Last time I was here, I was talking about people filing their self-assessment tax returns because it's that time of year. If you've got to do a return, you've got to get it in by the end of January. But sometimes people forget that as well as having to file their return by the end of January, they've also got to pay any tax that's due by the end of January as well. So really, it's just to give some hints and tips, really, to advise people what they've got to do and how they can do it.
So what should you do?
The first thing is if you can pay the tax that's due, then the 31st of January is that deadline. When you filed your return, if you filed it online, you should get calculations showing you how much is due, and make sure, if you can, that it's paid by the 31st of January. Then you won't get any interest or extra charges for late payments. But we know that sometimes people get to the 31st of January, and for one reason or another, sometimes they're not in a position where they can pay what's due. They know what's due, but they can't actually pay it. So first of all, what I would advise is have a look at what's due and see if it seems right, because sometimes somebody might have made a mistake when they completed their return, an extra naught on the end of something, which has meant that the amount that they're being charged is actually higher than it should be. So have a look at the amount that's due, see whether it looks right. If it looks right, like I say, if you can pay it, make sure you do so if you can before the 31st of January. But don't think just because if you can't afford to pay it by the 31st of January, well, I'll just pretend it's not all happening. If you can, give us a call. And we can sometimes talk to people what they can do about not being able to pay it. Sometimes we can come to an agreement. We can talk to people about their circumstances and see if there's anything that we can do to help them. This year, what a lot of people might have done is they might have got all the money together, paid it by the 31st of January, but then struggled to do so and think, is there an easier way I can do this next year? Now, the good thing is if you're up together with your tax, you can set up direct debits so that you can make payments on account of your liability that's going to arise during the course of the year. So if you've got some spare money, you can go use our online services and set up a direct debit to pay, you know, even it might be just £10 a month or something, you know, whatever you can afford. If that's what would be right for you and would work for you, then think about doing that. If you know that you might struggle to pay that, talk to us before the bill is due. So again, we can see what we can do. We've got a business payment support helpline, and I can give you the number for that in a moment. Give them a call and talk through what the difficulties are, and we can see if we can help you. If it's past the date when the tax is due, then you'll have probably had a demand through the post. You'll have had a request for payment. The best advice I can give you is don't ignore it. Even if you can't afford to pay it, please don't ignore it. There'll be a contact telephone number on that letter that you've had. There'll be your reference, and it'll say the office that sent it. Give them a call. Don't think, I can't afford to pay it, so I'm just not going to do anything. That's the worst possible thing, because we will keep sending out more and more demands. Whereas if you talk to us and we know what your circumstances are, then if there is something we can do to help you, then we'll do that. We'll work with you if we can.
And how should people get in contact with you?
www.hmrc.gov.uk. Lots and lots of information about various ways of paying and tips and hints about checking if your bill's correct and what you can do. Because there's another thing you can do as well. It's too late to do it for this year, but when you fill in your return, if you have a liability, in some cases you can actually, if you've got pay as you earn income, you can tick a box when you fill in the return. It's got to be done by the end of December, and then any underpayment can be collected through your pay as you earn code in the following year. So you don't then have to write that cheque out at the end of January and pay the pay. You can pay it effectively each week or month, however frequently you're paid. You can pay it through your tax code, so that the burden is eased a little bit. But you've got to make sure that your tax return is submitted a little bit earlier than the 31st of January deadline. So like I say, it's too late for this year, but it's worth bearing in mind for next year. If you've got to pay as your own source and you're going to have some tax due to pay, it's a possibility worth thinking about that might be the right option for you. Go on the website www.hmrc.gov.uk. Lots of information on there. Our business support helpline, 0845 302 1435. We've also got the online services number, which is 0845 6055999. And if you've got any general queries about self-assessment, we've also got a helpline number for that, which is 0845 900 0444. So there are different numbers for different things, but probably the best place to check is if you've got a particular query, go onto the website, have a look, and it will direct you to probably the solution that's best for you or the contact point that's best for you. But like I say, the best advice is, if you can pay what you owe, then please do so. Pay it by the due date. If you can't pay what you owe, then talk to us as soon as possible. Don't leave it, and then we will do what we can to work with you so that your bill is paid.
Well, thank you very much, and pay your taxes.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sarah. The Religious Society of Friends began in England in the 17th century. Members are informally known as Quakers, a word that means to tremble in the way of the Lord. The Society of Friends, whilst remaining small in membership, has been influential in the history of reform. Quaker entrepreneurs played a central role in forging the Industrial Revolution in England and in Pennsylvania, America. Over to Claverham Meeting House in Somerset to hear all about the Quakers. And you'll also hear a poltergeist story about the Sidcot Quaker Meeting House, as told by Tom Liemdorfer.
Going to talk about Claverham, which is a Quaker meeting house at Cleve.
Yes, well, it's near Cleve. It's still technically in Claverham, down Meeting House Lane. And it is rather a special Quaker meeting house, a historic meeting house. There are several around. I mean, the meeting house in Portishead is also a very old historic one. The Quaker movement started in middle of the 17th century with George Fox in the Lake District. The Quakers presented quite a challenge to all the religious establishments at the time. I mean, Catholics and Protestants had been fighting each other in various wars. The basis of Catholicism was a kind of infallible church, infallible pope. Protestants were looking at an infallible Bible, whichever way it was interpreted, always with priests and ministers interpreting was right, while the Quaker challenge was that you did not need priests and interpreters or any intermediary, that there is something of God in every human being, and there can be a direct relationship between each person seeking the truth, the light, and Creator, and an understanding of the teaching of Jesus. And so you didn't need church structures, you didn't need priests. So that wasn't popular with the established church, and there was a lot of persecution. So Quaker meetings and meeting houses couldn't be established until the Act of Toleration, which was at the end of the 17th century. And at Claverham, there were Quakers who were from the fairly wide area, from a rural area, and they were given a piece of land by a sympathizer, Richard Durbin, in 1688, who gave that piece of land for Quakers for a period of 2,000 years for them to have a meeting house and a burial ground. Now, the very first meeting house that was built was too small. The present meeting house was built in 1729 using much of the original material. And although it is kind of off the map in a very rural bit, it was a thriving meeting because it was the centre of a large rural peasant farmer community, many of whom were Quakers at the time and came on horseback. So the meeting house thrived through the 17th century. One interesting thing about it was that right from the start, apart from a place of Quaker worship, which is based on silence and anybody being able to minister if they feel led, man, woman, child, anyone. So they had meetings for worship, and there was meetings for business, for looking after people who may have been persecuted, who may have had goods, as it were, taken because they weren't paying tithes to the church. So looking after each other. So there were business meetings. And apart from that, they also had part of the meeting houses built as a possible place for housing any homeless Quakers, which was quite an interesting and unique idea. And together with other local meetings, as well at Sidcot at the time, and of course meeting at Bristol, number of Quakers in the area. The interesting thing about Claverham is that when the railways came and Yatton had a railway station, although Claverham Meeting House was only a couple of miles away, it was seen as remote. And so in the 1860s, Yatton Meeting House was built. And Claverham became not quite disused, but not used as a regular place of meeting, only an occasional meeting for worship. The Yatton Meeting House is now the Yatton Library. That fell into disuse in the 1930s. Now there are active Quaker meetings in North Somerset at Portishead, in Weston-super-Mare in Clevedon, and in Sidcot. And Claverham Meeting House is now owned by an independent Quaker trust, the Claverham Meeting House Trust, which was set up by actually the Clark family of Street. We have local connections with some of the people who are in the burial ground, the historical burial ground. So Claverham Meeting House is still used for meeting for worship once a month, and people come from neighbouring meetings. It hasn't got its own membership or congregation, as one would think. So people might come from anywhere, from Bath, Bristol, and we have meetings for worship on the last Sunday of each month in the afternoon. But apart from that, it's used for projects, for small concerts, for drama projects, for art exhibitions. People use it for holidays because one of the cottages can be hired for short breaks or holidays or away days or just people wanting a quiet time. The other side, the other cottage, we have part-time wardens who live there as a family. It's still very much a live project. This is a story of the Sidcot ghost that relates to the old Sidcot meeting house and the school, the old school. The old meeting house of 1718 and the more northerly of the two cottages, which are divided from it by the steep and narrow lane called Harbour Badge, were the scene less than 20 years before the foundation of the current Sidcot school of a remarkable occurrence, whose details, whether due to supernatural agency or mere trickery, have never been explained. The house across the lane was the residence of a man called George Beecham, a man who passed in the district not only for a cattle doctor, but as a bit of a conjurer. And the tradition even credits him with wearing a red cap and with the possession of a wizard's staff and magic books. When he was on the point of death, he told his wife to bury him not in consecrated ground, but in the adjoining crossroads, so that as he lay in his grave, he might have the amusement of watching the passers-by. "If ye don't," said the old man, "I'll trouble ye." Now, this last request of his was not complied with, and his ashes were laid in the Winscombe churchyard. A year went by, and then one Wednesday morning, on the 22nd of July, 1789, 12 months apparently to the very day when the old wizard departed this life, while friends, Quakers, were sitting at the Quaker meeting, and John Banwell's boys from the school among them, a terrified woman who lived with the conjurer's widow and who was a caretaker of the meeting house came rushing in and broke the solemn silence by crying, "Oh, neighbours, do come, here be old widow Beecham's all things a-walling about the floor." So two friends, John Banwell of the elders and Charles Strode, got up, walked quietly out, crossed the lane to Beecham Cottage, and so the story goes, the chairs, the tables, and the pots and plants dancing about the room, and the kneading trough, which the old widow used to make cakes, and which she sold for a little shop, that was rocking to and fro as if moved by some invisible hands. More than that, the astonished onlookers saw the dead man's boots clattering downstairs into the kitchen. Now, the two friends looked and wondered. They could find no solution to the mystery. The disturbances didn't cease even after the Quaker meeting, which continued, when that broke up. So other friends came across, and even some of them saw what was happening. Among them was John Banwell's daughter Hannah, who long afterwards used to describe how, as she entered the cottage kitchen, she had to avoid a large and heavy armchair, which was moving slowly across the room. Now, Hannah Moore, whose labours amongst the Mendip miners began in the very year when this happens, is said to have driven over from Cowslip Green at Rington to inquire into the circumstances. And the favourite Mr. Jones of Mendip Annals, then curate and afterwards rector and Shipham, who taught French in John Banwell's school and also visited Beecham's cottage. But neither they nor any other inquirer could ever determine whether the disturbance was caused by the unquiet spirit of the disappointed conjurer or whether it was merely a result of some trickery.
Thanks, Tom. The Albion Band sing "Why Have They Stolen Our Earth?"
Years we've been greedy and blind, never noticed the damage that's caused by mankind. But now we are being taken to task, and there's one question all children ask:
why have you stolen our earth?
Nobody told us how much it was worth. We want to make up for that now, and the children are showing us how.
The hedgerows and ditches have gone. You tell us that's progress, you had to move on. Instead, we've got mountains of wheat and icebergs of unwanted meat. The price paid for power can be high. Chernobyl showed you by clouding the sky. But power could be safe and be free. Use the sun and the wind and the sea. So why have you stolen our earth?
Nobody told us how much it was worth. We want to make up for that now. And the children are showing us how.
Things are as bad near a home there'll soon be no wild space for children to roam if the builders keep getting their way, destroying the place where we play. We think that there's something obscene about building on fields that are still fresh and green. If Monopoly is what you must play, choose land that is ugly and grey. So why have you stolen our earth?
Nobody told us how much it was worth. We want to make up for that now, and the children are showing us how.
You don't have to follow the rest, believing the biggest is always the best. Sometimes it pays to think small, and sometimes do nothing at all. So the lesson is really quite plain. Go back to square one and start caring again. We can't tell you what to expect, but at least you'll have earned our respect. Oh, why have you stolen our earth?
Nobody told us how much it was worth. We want to make up for that now, and the children are showing us how.
In English economic history, enclosure or inclosure is the process which ends traditional rights such as mowing meadows for hay or grazing cattle on common land, formerly held in the open field system. Once enclosed, these uses of land become restricted to the owner and it ceases to be lands for the commons. In England and Wales, the term is also used for the process that ended the ancient system of arable farming in open fields. Under enclosure, such land is fenced, enclosed, and entitled or deeded to one or more owners. The process of enclosure began to be a widespread feature of the English agricultural landscape during the 18th century. By the 19th century, unenclosed common land had become restricted to rough pasture in mountain areas and to relatively small parts of the lowlands. Now over to the Cube Cinema in Bristol, where a film about the commons and a lecture took place.
My name's Sy Taffel. I'm finishing up a PhD and work as an associate lecturer at the University of Bristol and the University of West of England. And so the talk that I gave today was about the idea of the commons and different types of commons that exist. Thinking back historically, because one of the places people often encounter the idea of commons is to do with land in England before the Enclosure Acts in 17th century, when people would have land as a common resource, which was there for anyone to graze cattle on or grow kind of subsistence crops. So the land was a resource that anyone within the area could access and use in order to sustain themselves. And the Enclosure Act saw that common land become a private property with a mandated owner, the land ownership that we're more familiar with today. So that's the first type of commons, in which access relies on you actually physically being there. So it's a local access model, but the ownership of the resource itself is distributed. No one had final say over the commons. There wasn't a local commons manager who told everyone what they were allowed to do or police things. It was a kind of self-policing communal system. A second model of commons we encounter is something that you could associate with, for example, public services like the National Health Service in this country. So again, it's something which is a communal resource. It's there for everyone. It doesn't matter who you are. If you get knocked down in the road, the ambulance will come and pick you up and take you to a hospital where you will get looked after and get medical care and nursed back to some kind of state at which you're able to take yourself home. However, it's a type of commons which is quite different from the communal land model, because the ownership of something like the NHS is quite vertically integrated. The NHS is something which is managed in that vertical, hierarchical way, because the logic was, rather than having a system where a few hundred people could manage the resource by themselves and they didn't need any kind of oversight or management, as a system that was there for tens of millions of people, it was something which needed to be centralised and managed. The rationale which comes from places more recently like Garrett Hardin's 1968 Tragedy of the Commons essay is that commons can work at a small scale when there's just a few people who usually know each other, where you can have trust that's built up through kind of embodied relationships. But when you start talking about systems that work at far bigger scales, so within the country, we certainly don't know everyone else in the UK, that kind of trust and direct relationship doesn't exist. And so in order to actually make things function, people thought you actually needed things to be a quite strict vertical hierarchy. Now, the third type of commons relates to what we call kind of peer-to-peer based commonwealth, and it's something which is seen as a relatively recent development and is quite tied to technological advancements, particularly to do with microelectronics and the ability of people to communicate with potentially enormous groups of people over internet-based systems. So when you look at something like a piece of free and open source software or a kind of commons-led media project, something like, say, Wikipedia, what you find is that you can have an enormous number of people contributing to a project who aren't tied to a particular geography, as in commons-based land management, but in which there doesn't seem to need to be the kind of vertical integration we find with public services like the NHS. Projects like Wikipedia don't have that managerial hierarchy. Open source projects, anyone can go and get involved in them. And actually, your involvement is something which evolves over time and depends on your capacity to be involved. It's a kind of peer certification scheme where you do work with people and people will recognise your work, and so you'll get passed other bits and pieces. It's the equivalent of being able to walk into a hospital and start doing some of the jobs, and if people think you're doing a good job, they pass you over to brain surgery. And so this is quite a different way of being able to manage commons, and it's quite interesting in that it suggests that actually it's a method of having commonly managed assets, but which can scale, and which can scale across national borders, and which can involve enormous numbers of people. And actually, when you look at some of the successes of the open source movement, you look at things like Apache Linux, which is the most heavily used operating system and back-end server software that runs most of the World Wide Web that we encounter on a daily basis. You look at Wikipedia, the most popular encyclopedic reference site around. It's one of the top 10 most popular websites in the world, with hundreds of millions of people using it every week. And it comes together through a distributed group of people just getting together and working together and evolving rules as they go along in terms of management and stewardship. And it's something which has been extremely popular and extremely successful. And in cases like those, in cases like thinking about web browsers with Mozilla Firefox and Google's Chrome, what we've seen is that these peer-to-peer systems are actually able to economically outcompete proprietary market-based systems. So the main rival to Apache and Linux is Microsoft's Windows and their proprietary web software, which costs a huge amount of money to buy, which has hundreds of dedicated software engineers and developers working on it, but which has proved less successful. And not less successful because it costs money, because actually when you're talking about big businesses hosting their websites, what's actually really pivotal to what platform they opt for is reliability. And which product does the job better? Having to pay a little bit for software doesn't come into it, but the open source solution has ended up being the more resilient one. Similarly with web browsers, and more people now are using Firefox and Chrome than they are Microsoft's Internet Explorer. WordPress, which is a piece of open source software, is now used to make most websites. It was originally blogging software and it was open source, and because of the way it's evolved with various plugins and skins that you can put into it, WordPress now means that actually most people with very little technical competency can put together a fairly complex website which allows people to feedback and write comments, which has a design that reflects what they would like to do with the website without needing to know how to hand code everything in HTML or CSS. And so again, it's something that's proved tremendously popular, far more so than the proprietary alternatives. Where I think this gets really interesting at the moment, though, is the crossover from open source software to open source hardware and maker culture, and the fact that people are going from making software and things which the entire product can be delivered online and shared online, to sharing the designs for physical objects, which can be made using things like 3D printers, which again there are open source designs in the world for now, and which have actually massively decreased the price of that technology. And I think this is really exciting because it points to a model which departs from an economies of scale based industry, whereby most of our microelectronics or our socks or our glasses frames are made in enormous factories in China and then shipped out across the world. It allows regular people to actually download designs from repositories like Thingiverse and then to modify them if they want, so you can have a customized version of whatever object it is, and then to make or print this yourself using openly available data. And this actually really gives a potential for us to move away from an industrial culture based on commodified relations and allows people to start making and creating things themselves.
The Cube Cinema is one of the few independent cinemas in Britain, and there is a big campaign to buy the cinema. Let's hear more.
So I'm at the Cube Cinema. Hello.
Hi, my name is Jelena. I work at the Cube and I've been here since 2004.
Exciting news. You're actually going to buy the building. Tell us more about it.
It is indeed, yeah. We've been negotiating with the landlord that we've been renting this place off for years. And negotiations have been going for 2 years. And finally, we're able to say that we've come to a deal. We've come to the number. It's £185,000 and we have a year expiring in December to raise the funds to buy the building, that's the Cube Cinema.
So you've got 40,000 raised already.
We do indeed, thanks to lovely donors and members of the Cube who have supported us so far since the start of the appeal.
Now, you promote films made by young people.
Yes, indeed. Well, Cube is a very varied institution. It's a place of experiment, not just for film but also for social things, because the Cube started in 98 by a bunch of people who were doing something called Club Rhombus, who were doing like club cinema screenings around Bristol. So when they had the opportunity to come into this building and hire it, they wanted to show films that you couldn't see anywhere else in Bristol. So, and they thought they would make money out of it. And within weeks, it was apparent that that wasn't going to happen. So Cube became volunteer cinema straight away. And we are still volunteer cinema. Nobody ever gets paid. There is about 200 people, about 30, 40 people who are core staff. And we're really proud that we never, ever received funding from the council, from the Arts Council, or from the city for costs for running the Cube. So we're really free to program really diverse things here. And it's not just films. And if you see our program, our films are really different. Not very well known, but important international filmmakers who will make film with their hands and analog, who will play with celluloid. We have Blue Cinema, that's one of our longest going projects, and it's like an open screen night where people, young people, filmmakers from Bristol come in and show their films that are up to 20 minutes long. And that has been really popular. That night happened once a month, and some of them have gone on to make feature films and feature documentaries. So I think Cube is definitely a place of that nurtures young people, but also nurtures any kind of experimentation and real freedom in programming.
Do you think you're unique in Britain?
We are not unique in Britain. There is another project in Newcastle that has started after the model of the cube 7 years ago. They're called Star and Shadow in Newcastle. There are a few other cinemas that are similar to the cube in Europe, but we are certainly unique for Bristol, and this is not a model that's very common.
It takes a lot of dedication, but the reason we're doing this interview tonight is to raise money, isn't it, to save the cube. So let's get the ball rolling.
Yes, thank you.
Should we say 100,000 people could send you £10 each?
Yes, that would be great, or more or less. And don't forget to fill in the form that says that you're a tax donor so that we can have more money. And for more information, you can visit the Cube website, which is cubecinema.com/freehold, where you can download all these links or donate online or see more information what we intend to do with the building after we have bought it. Yeah. But also you can just send in the checks made out to Microplus Holdings, Cube Cinema, 4 Princess Row, Bristol, BS2, 8NQ.
So if the public are listening and they want to donate, they shouldn't delay because time's running out. Is that right?
Absolutely. And it's very, very important for us to raise as much money as early as possible because we're also looking at public funding. And obviously, the more support we have in advance, the more they will be prepared to give us match funding. So it's very important to have as much money as soon as possible.
Lack of schools in Britain. We go over to the Arnolfini to find out what's happening in the education sector from a leading London architect who specialises in designing educational projects.
Cindy Walters, director of Walters & Co in Architects, based in London.
There's a huge demand for school places at the moment and not enough schools. Could you just enlarge on that?
Well, we're being told by the Education Funding Agency, the Department for Education, that there is approximately 260,000 school places required across the country. A lot of them are centred around the big cities, and they are mainly at the moment in primary education, but they obviously that bulge will move through into secondary education soon enough.
You also talked about the austerity period and how you were being constrained by materials. There's been a big cutback in materials and space. Could you tell us more about that?
It's not so much materials, because schools have never had big budgets for materials, but we are being required to reduce space in schools by approximately 15%. So at the moment there's a building bulletin, 98 and 99, which govern both primary and secondary schools and set out space requirements. We're being advised that we will need to work to space standards that are 15% less than is currently in those building bulletins.
That's quite disappointing, isn't it? Because the architects have worked hard with their clients to ensure that more space means less bullying, less social problems.
I think there are some things we need to just be careful not to lose sight of. There's been a lot of work done in recent years and a lot of work done through the Building Schools for the Future programme on things like not having, you know, lots of long, narrow corridors, not having stairwells tucked away, not having blocks of toilets that are unsupervised. Those are areas that were identified as being linked to behavioural issues in schools, and a lot of work has been done in the better schools that were designed under Building Schools for the Future to design out those problems. I just think that those are things we need to hang on to and make sure that in the new wave of schools that are being built under the Priority School Build programme, that all those lessons that were learned we hang on to, because they're very important.
You were inspired by schools in Denmark. Could you just tell us what about the schools inspired you most?
A couple of schools that I've seen in Denmark have been full of light and air, using high-quality materials, creating high-quality teaching and learning spaces, very strong links to the outdoors. All the things that we have done, try to do in our school buildings in this country, but they do set... There's a high standard of school design. There's been a lot of money invested in school design in Denmark, a lot of money invested in research. And you can see in the high quality of the buildings, they are quite inspiring. So,
how important is it for you to work with the clients, the head teachers, the staff, to know what their requirements are?
It's absolutely critical. It's essential to the outcome. It's essential to the school community feeling that the building that they get has been designed for them and meets their requirements. And it's fascinating. Every school is run differently. People have different requirements and aspirations. That in itself causes a bit of a problem, because I think there's a nervousness from the government that
individual requirements of specific head teachers or members of staff can lead architects in different directions, and you might end up with a school that's very specific to that person's requirements, and the next head comes along and doesn't think it's right at all. I think you do have to be careful of that, and we are very careful about that, but I think the idea of involving people in the building that they are going to end up working in and using is so fundamental to the design process that it's not just about schools. You can't design any building without listening to the people who are going to use the building and understanding how they need to use it and what it is that they actually need.
Do you find that as technology advances, the requirements change with it that you have to provide in the school buildings?
Yes, there's been great advancement in IT, for example, in the last few years. People have the days of having a computer classroom where you have everybody sitting behind a computer facing the front are gone. There's been great work done in integrating IT into the whole school, making sure there are IT-rich breakout areas where people can use a tablet, work at a tablet or a laptop anywhere in the school, and that's the way of the future. So that has had a big impact on the way we design schools, the way we think about resource areas, about breakout spaces. Yeah, so that's just one example of where technology has had a big impact on the designs of schools. The other is in environmental sustainability. We are moving further and further towards buildings that are extremely efficient environmentally, and that, of course, changes the way you design the building. It changes everything about the building, which is fantastic. So it's another thing we need to hang on to. It's that all buildings, not just schools, need to be as efficient environmentally as they possibly can be.
Do you have a project on the go at the moment? Are you working on a big project?
Yeah, we're working on a lot of projects at the moment, a lot of education projects. I think our biggest project, which is on site, is in Somers Town in London. It's called South Camden Community School. In fact, it's just about to change its name to Regent High School. It was a project that was funded under BSF. It was one of the last BSF projects to get its funding. It was being built in a great number of phases with the school on the site. We're just moving into the final phase now, which is very exciting. It's all coming together. It'll be one to watch, I hope, and it'll be a very unique school when it's finished.
That was Anthea Page interviewing Cindy Waters at one of a series of architecture lectures being held at the Arnolfini in Bristol. A poem from Martin Reiser, read by Judith Reiser.
After the rains, waking to a rattled skylight, February barely penetrating the blinds, swaying in the garden tracery, three birds among jewelled branches, blackcap, fieldfare and thrush, quarrelling for seeds and crab apples. A wet cat crouches, bewildered, when a lorry Doppler's passed with thunderous suddenness and retreating hiss. A sock left on the stair. The house makes reassuring sounds and settles to the day. Turn from the window. One more tea. The business of beginning.
Over to Tim Burrows, who has now his visa for India and is set to disappear for a month. Backchat this week. Studio engineer was Adrian Petrowski and the producer was Anthea Page. So it's goodbye from me, Kirsty Paul. And until next week, goodbye.